You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Jimmy Conrad has spent his entire adult life in and around the sport of soccer. He was a four-year letter winner in high school before heading to San Diego State. He stayed there for 2 years before transferring to UCLA, where he was part of the Bruins' 1997 national championship team. Wasn't drafted by MLS then in its second year, but he managed to catch on with a lower level team and eventually the MLS club in San Jose. He helped the Earthquakes win the 2001 MLS Cup. He was traded to the Kansas City Wizards, now Sporting Kansas City, in 2003 and stayed there for seven seasons. 2004, Conrad helped the Wizards to the U.S. Open Cup title and the MLS Cup final as the leader of the league's stingiest defense. That season, he was named to the league's Best 11, which is MLS's version of an all-pro team. And he was a finalist for MLS Defender of the Year, an award he won the next year. He earned 27 caps with the U.S. men's national team and participated in a 2006 FIFA World Cup. He was named Man of the Match in an international friendly against Mexico in 2007 when he scored his first goal for the national team. He has his own YouTube channel, so maybe we can get him to post this on that channel since he's on ours. Jimmy, welcome to Sports Connections.
Yeah, thank you for having me. You should be my publicist. That was a great intro.
My pleasure. Now, you played soccer in high school. Did you play, and college and pro, obviously, did you play any other sports competitively?
I played baseball growing up. And not to say, I mean, my dad knew the game. That was the game my dad knew. So we would, you know, throw the ball around in the front yard, you know, work on, you know, swinging techniques and all that type of stuff. That's the one that he probably felt most comfortable teaching me, per se. He wasn't a big soccer guy. My grandfather was born in Denmark and he would kick the ball around with me. So I pretty much picked up the soccer bug from my grandpa, but it was good. It's important to play multiple sports. It's important to be exposed to different games and different coaches and kind of see what sticks and what you feel best about. I did play a lot of basketball with my friends, a lot of pickup basketball. But what I found is that a lot of similarities to soccer in terms of how you create space, how you move, how you work with others to create that space. And so it was a nice kind of, I don't know, it was a nice blend with soccer and what I was already thinking about and the sports that I enjoyed. So at age 11, I had a coach. We had a really good all-star team at our area. I was playing AYSO, you know, the little public soccer thing, nothing private or anything. And we had a really good all-star team. We were dominating everybody in Southern California. And so our coach had a son that was playing in college at Northridge. I said, hey, maybe you should take over these guys. And so he pretty much had to sit down with all the parents and say, you know, your kids are 11. They really need to specify on one sport. When I don't really want to have anybody on the team that's playing two or three different sports. You gotta pick, you gotta choose. And for me, it was pretty easy. It was a game that I knew that I was drawn to in a lot of different ways. And it wasn't as rigid as baseball. Baseball is very rigid. I mean, a play comes to you, you know exactly what you need to do. Whereas soccer is a little bit more fluid. The decisions can change in an instant. And I liked that there was that room for creativity that I don't think baseball allowed me to have.
Yeah. And certainly I see some similarity. I've often talked about the similarity between hockey and basketball, and it's best seen behind the net, behind the goal. And it's true in soccer. There are fast breaks. I mean, that you're playing on such a big pitch, and I use the right word, so yeah, on such a big field, that it's hard to see that there's fast breaks, but there really are. If you get a striker coming up the middle and he's got wings, you know, to see where those guys are going. Yeah, there's not the structure that there is in baseball, but they still know where that other guy's going to be because there is some similarity with organizing the fast break. Is that accurate?
100%. I think what I've really been impressed with from my time in Kansas City, you know, I spent many, many years there and I was captain for a long time and we played at Arrowhead and we played at Community America Ballpark before we went to that new cathedral of a stadium, Sporting Park, which is amazing. What I've been most impressed with throughout this evolution is the savvy of the Kansas City fans. At one point, you know, they would cheer for the obvious stuff. Oh, a goal. Oh, a big kick, you know, a big save. And that's fine. And those are our times to cheer. But now they also applaud when the team is under a little bit of pressure, they have a good defensive play, and then somebody plays out of a tough spot out of pressure and maybe switches the point of attack, right? And that is very for lack of a better description, European, right? That they're understanding the nuances and subtleties of the game. So yes, to your point, there are a ton of fast break opportunities. And what we call on this side is called a counterattack. But ultimately, what I think is the fun part about the game and where I love it because I'm getting all my coaching licenses now is team shape. So you're essentially baiting teams to play in a certain area. And then when you win the ball in that area, how can you then fast break? How can you then counter them and then hopefully exploit their weaknesses? And so, yeah, there's so much of that going on. And the more games you go to, the more you're going to see it. And just like any other sport, right, you get to understand the subtlety and nuance. And I think that's what really draws you in. You're like, oh, there is method to the magic that I'm seeing.
And I'm a typical American that I grew up watching and playing baseball and football and basketball, and soccer was the thing that other people that didn't speak English spoke or played.
Right.
And my son actually got me excited. He was in the mission field for a while, came home for a short period of time. And while he was home, he went, you know, he wanted to go to a sporting game and he took me to the game, and I stood in the cauldron the whole game. And the cauldron, for the people outside of Kansas City, is basically like the American Outlaws. It's the cheering section where everybody stands the whole game. And I came home, my wife said, "What'd you think?" I said, "I'm too old for this." And she said, "Too old to watch a sport?" I said, "Too old to stand for the whole game and sing songs I didn't know and stuff." But it is definitely something that grabs your attention. And you become I'm a sporting Kansas City fan.
That's
now.
That's it.
This was a Christmas present from my son a couple of years ago.
That's amazing. No, just to touch upon that, because I think what you're saying is very valuable. And what I love about the sport, because I've traveled all around the world and have seen it in different ways. And now that I've retired, you know, I'm engaging with the sport more in a fan way than I would as a professional player. So it brings people together. And what I love is that, or I guess just to compare and contrast with the other sports, baseball for me felt very, it's me and my dad. Me and my dad are going to the game. I'm not really interacting with the other fans so much, unless the umpire makes a bad call and then we're all standing up, and, you know, yeah, that type of stuff, right? There's definitely some, everybody's in on it once the umpire makes a bad call. But, and then with football and basketball, hockey to a certain extent too, those feel very TV sports, right? So they have a lot of timeouts, so they can build in commercials. There's not that fluidity. But then with soccer, it's just something different. You know, you're there, you're part of a collective. It doesn't matter what your background is, what your culture is, man. For that 90 minutes, we're all in this together. We're going to urge our team on to win. And I think that makes it really special. And I think once you, who haven't been exposed to it and grew up the way that you did, get sucked in, you're like, wow, this is amazing. Now, I feel like the Chiefs touched that, I think, out in the parking lot before the game. The pregame stuff's amazing, right?
Yeah.
But once you go into the stadium, it loses that feel a little bit. They're trying to replicate it in some ways, but it's not the same as going to a game with Sporting and standing and screaming the whole time.
Unless the ref makes a bad call.
That's of course, everybody's on the same page with that.
Yeah. I want to go back to your playing career, and actually early in your playing career, the reason you said you stuck with soccer and it was an easy choice, is it because you were really good at it? Is that what drew, I mean, we all tend to go to things that we excel at. Is that why you stuck with soccer?
I would say that's part of it, but I was pretty good at baseball too. But I'd get beaned a lot. I think that was part of it, because I would lean in. I was aggressive on the plate, you know, and obviously you're going up against younger players who are still learning how to pitch. And so I'd get hit a lot. And that I don't think made me that big of a fan of wanting to stick it out with baseball. But I usually had to be two positions on the field. I had to be the catcher. I had to be first base. I had to be involved in every single play. And if I wasn't, I just couldn't get engaged. I couldn't lock in the same way. Whereas with soccer, right, you have to be pretty switched on the whole time.
Yeah.
And so I liked that. I liked that feel of being able to change a game in a moment. You know, obviously you can do that at baseball with one swing, but you know, you can pick up a ball at midfield, dribble through five guys and score. And I was doing that, you know, and that feeling was harder to replicate in baseball. And then I as much as the in high school, the football coaches wanted to bring me in and be like a wide receiver or a defensive back, I just wasn't feeling American football. So I respected all the guys that did. Obviously, those are the ones that get all the girls in high school. So you have to kind of bow down to that sport. But soccer was for me at that point.
And why defense? I know you're 6'2", so the defenders tend to be taller. Maybe not, I don't want to insult you. Maybe not as quick as the strikers. But why defense?
So I started off as a striker and midfielder, somebody that was kind of pulling the strings and moving the attack along. And everything was running through me when I was a kid, even in high school. I was the center attacking mid, the number 10, as they like to say. And I think I had 17 goals and 12 assists my senior year. So I wasn't a slouch in that department. Yeah. But as I got older, I started to just have some really good instincts defensively. And I think a lot of it was due to the fact that I knew where the space was. I was developing an understanding of how to break down defenses. So then when I became a defender myself, I had a really good, I was intuitive in terms of what other teams and players were trying to do. And so I would dabble a little bit. I'd play in the outside back, you know, in a back four. I would maybe play in the middle a little bit. And I was just really comfortable. I wouldn't get rattled. I had a good demeanor about myself. It seemed like when I had the ball back there, the team would relax, you know, so it allowed us to transition, even though I was a little bit deeper on the field. And I could read the game really well. So those tendencies lent itself for me to be a defender. And then to your point, I wasn't the quickest guy. And so it allowed me to find a spot where I could be a pro for 12 years and I could get paid for kicking a ball around with other grown men in small shorts, because I was good at defending.
Man, you just, you know, that visual image there. I had a question ready and it's just gone. So I'll go to my next one. And I had a really good transition and it's just totally gone.
Sorry, my jokes are just too much.
No, that's quite all right. Now, as a defender, your responsibility is not scoring goals, but you did manage to score a few goals despite playing defense. Is there one goal that sticks in your mind? That was my favorite. Maybe you did pick it up in the, you know, in the defensive end, dribble through three guys, whatever, or was it on a corner? Do you have a favorite memory?
I have a couple what ifs where I did play. There's one, honestly, it would have been a highlight reel. I would roll it in people's faces right now. Like, roll the clip. I want you guys to see how good I used to be. But no, we were playing in New York and we gave up a ball in a bad area and it ended up being like a 3v2. And they had three, we had two, and it's me and somebody else. And we're like, oh, great, here we go. So they're countering us, and I steal the ball from the main dribbler. He just takes too big of a touch. I read what he wanted to do. I steal it, and now they're not set. So I play a ball to Chris Klein, who played for Kansas City for a long time, president of the Galaxy now, and I keep running. Like, usually when you're a defender, you just get it and give it to the attacking guys and just go back to your position. I just kept running because I saw some space. He plays me in, and now I'm 1v1 with the goalkeeper, and I completely – I can't believe I'm in that spot. I just have that moment of, I should have just stayed with the concentrating on what I needed to do. And instead I got a little bit overwhelmed from how is this even possible that I'm 1v1 right now? So, you know, we're in New York, we're in Giant Stadium. You can feel the atmosphere and all that. And I tried to get a little bit too cute. I cut the goalkeeper, but a defender had tracked back and I shot it and he cleared it off the line or whatever. So I had a great what if, and I still think about it a lot. 'Cause like, I should have just shot initially, but my biggest goal in my career was probably against Mexico, playing for the U.S. men's national team.
Right.
They're our biggest rivals. And I scored, made it 1-0. I was man of the match. And it was a pretty thrilling time in my life and definitely the peak in terms of my attacking prowess.
All right. Now, as a defender, who was the toughest striker you had to defend in your MLS career?
My MLS career, there was a player named Carlos Ruiz who played for the Galaxy for many years. Yeah. His nickname was El Pescadito, so the little fish. And it's because he flopped a lot, right? He was always flopping around. And he was fantastic in terms of creating contact before the ball got there. So I liken it to, I don't know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or any like great center back in the day that would get good positioning in the key before they would, you know, get the ball. And then once they got you in that spot, you were dead. Like, they just had the angles, and then, you know, you can't stop a sky hook. You can't stop that stuff. And so Carlos Ruiz had very similar tendencies and instincts where he would body you up. And by the time the ball got there, you would try to get back in position and then you'd foul him or try to be physical with him. And then he'd flop and then he'd get the foul. You're like, wait a second. He's the one that initiated all the contact, you know? So there was a lot of that, and his savvy and cunning was really next level. And I don't know if he gets spoken about as much as he should, because he was not only a great player, but he was a great villain. And I feel like every league, every sport needs a great villain.
Yeah.
You need somebody who's going to embrace just being a jerk out there, because it really does get the fans engaged and fired up and for a lot of reasons. And I think adds that emotion and the entertainment value. So we miss him in a lot of different ways, but he was always the toughest because you had to figure out a way to not let him get body position. I'm talking like 5 seconds before the ball gets there because he's so good at knowing where it's going to come. And obviously they're set up, their whole offense is set up around him. So I thought he was the toughest. There were some other players to bring up my speed again, where I would at times, especially early on when I was younger, maybe a little bit more naive in terms of my positioning, where the fast guys would eat me up and spit me out. Yeah. So I obviously got more savvy and cunning with regard to how to have better better starting positions and how to negate that speed. But yeah, it took a while.
For sure. Now, I want to go back to something. I wasn't prepared for this, but it's interesting. You talk about the villain other than the yellow team. And my son said his favorite his favorite chant in the cauldron is after the officials make a bad call that they'll start chanting yellow team sucks. But other than the official, or I guess, you know, the, you got the side guys, and I'm just totally having a brain cramp on what all
assistant referees or sideline refs. Yeah.
Okay. So the main official is the only guy who's actually on the field.
Yeah. Center ref, yeah.
So other than that, there is something about the villain for sporting fans. It was the guy from with the dreads with Real Salt Lake.
Yeah, Kyle Beckerman.
Beckerman, you know, and their goalkeeper, and I'm not sure why I'm having trouble with names today.
Yeah, Nick Raimondo.
Nick Raimondo. I mean, my son still has it somewhere in his house, picture or a poster that he held up for that 2013 MLS Cup game of making fun of Nick Raimondo. And so there is something that maybe it's worldwide, but certainly Americans take to. If there is somebody on the other team that nobody likes, it makes it easier to root for your team against him. Is that a worldwide thing, or is that more American?
I would say that it's worldwide for sure. I think that is just a natural human reaction. You know, if you've got some player in particular who's running his mouth, then all of a sudden he comes to your town.
Yeah.
You're going to definitely pay the extra money for that ticket to go make sure you can yell and run your mouth at him while he can't do anything in return. So yeah, I think that's pretty global with regard to that. What's funny is I was at that 2013 MLS Cup game. It was fun to be there. I didn't play, obviously. I had retired at that point, but to really see the evolution of Kansas City sports and Kansas City soccer, frankly, to go from Arrowhead to Community America to this. And I think it just really validated when they won that, the owners for making that decision and taking that risk and putting all that money in and really making something magical happen. So that was a great moment. And I was really happy for the club. And then Nick Raimondo was my teammate in college. So it's pretty funny that you guys.
Oh, that is funny.
Time. Yeah,
that is funny. Okay. Now, you obviously played in the MLS in the very early days. I think your rookie year was the second year, maybe the third year of the league. How has the MLS game changed since your playing days?
Well, this is what I'll say, and I find it interesting because I'm having a conversation, like a running conversation, with some younger players now about what is it harder to get to MLS now or back then? Because back then, there were only 10 teams in the league, and you had to make the 18-man roster. So there's only 180 spots in this country to play professional soccer at the highest level. I think we can make a strong argument it was harder back then, but there's more visibility now and more kids are playing. So maybe it's harder now. It's really interesting. So what I'll say is it's an incredible adventure that I've been on to see it from back then till now. I was in San Jose to start. I made $24,000. You're going to probably think I'm going to say per month or a week. I made $24,000 for a whole year. That was my, I made $800.14 every, that was my paycheck. I remember, I wish I'd had the courage to save one and frame it, you know, but I needed that money to pay for my rent. So I couldn't do it, but $800.14. So just think about how far that's gone. I mean, the minimum is up to, I think, 85 or 90,000 a year, which is good. And it's continuing its upward trend. And it was a crazy time. But my favorite part was we would go to Spartan Stadium where San Jose State plays. That's where our home games were. We weren't allowed to train on any of San Jose State's fields, any training fields, not the stadium fields. We had to get in our car and drive 30 minutes to some youth complex and then train next to like some, you know, U10 teams, which is amazing. And then we'd get back in our cars and have to drive all the way back up for a meeting or shower or all that stuff. And just to see that small piece and where that is now, where these multi-million dollar training facilities and, you know, guys are getting massages every, like, what? I couldn't even imagine getting a massage every day or having that type of, you know, ice bath or any of that stuff. So all these little things have started to layer up and add so much professionalism to the game. And that makes me excited because that's only going to help us produce better players. And we're already seeing the fruits of that labor. So it's it's been very cool to see that. And obviously having soccer specific stadiums is the obvious one, but from more granular level and kind of seeing it, that was always the biggest thing. I was always so impressed. And now it's even, you know, now I feel like the MLS clubs are trying to one up each other, right? Yeah. No, my training facility is better than yours. We treat our players better than you treat yours, you know? So, and I like that. That's a good competition to have because that just means everything's going to get better and better.
And that's really the cultural way to answer that question, or, you know, I mean, you're answering about how the culture of MLS is different. What about the game itself? I mean, it's called the beautiful sport because it's so simple and yet it's complicated.
Sure.
Has the MLS game itself changed in the 25 years of MLS?
We could sit down and have beers and talk about this for a while. So what I'll say is, and I'll give you a good example here. Back when I started, there was 10 teams, again, 18 players per team, but you had to be excellent to make that roster. I look at the DC United teams that won multiple MLS Cups in the first 5-6 years of the league. If you looked at one of their starting teams in one of those MLS Cups, all 11 of those starters played for a national team, whether it was the US, Bolivia, whatever it was, they all were national team starters. If you go look at the MLS now, you could pick any team, Kansas City, right? You might have four or five national team players on a roster. Yeah. So I think in some ways, due to the expansion, we've diluted the talent pool a little bit. And that's a normal part of it, right? The more we add, the more dilution of talent there's going to be. At some point, they've got to cap it, and they've got to let that infrastructure and everything underneath start to rise up. And we're starting to see that, right? We've seen some youth academies that have gotten a big head start. FC Dallas in particular have done a very good job. They're now selling players to Europe for multi-million dollar deals.
Yeah.
And that's really, I'm just using them as an example. I know Sporting Kansas City had Eric Palmer Brown. You know, he's a good example, a local example for everybody in KC. And that's a great thing, you know, where you're starting to litter your own team with homegrown prospects, but also if one of them is super special, you can move them on. I think Gianluca Busio is another one for Kansas City that's like on the precipice of doing something similar.
What's the maximum number of teams MLS should have? I mean, obviously, we talk about this every time there's discussion about baseball expansion or, you know, there's only a certain number of pitchers who can throw strikes.
That's right.
There's only a certain number of players. So what's your opinion of the maximum number of teams MLS should have?
You know, I used to write for Sports Illustrated /ESPN when I was a player. And in 2009, I wrote a big article about the future of MLS and what I thought it should look like. Around the world, there's promotion relegation, right? So you don't have any playoffs, which is a very American type thing to look at sports. And what happens over, if everybody's in the, you know, any casual fans out there, I'll use the Premier League as an example. There's 20 teams in the top division. You play everybody twice, home and away. Seems pretty fair. 38 games in total. And the winner after 38 games is the champ, you know, pretty straightforward. And if you're one of the bottom three teams, you get relegated to the second division. And the top three teams in the second division get promoted to the top. And I think that soccer would really benefit from that. I don't think the infrastructure had been there for very long. It's starting to now evolve, as I've been talking about. And I think they're starting to become a little bit more of a robust second and third and fourth division here in this country, but there's still some things to work through. So I kind of had proposed that maybe MLS, because they have a very unique single entity structure, and I don't want to get everybody bored about the finance side of things, but if they got to 30, maybe 40 teams, and then they could split it up into two divisions themselves, MLS 1 and MLS 2. And that way you could kind of find that compromise where you're still in control with your unique business model, but you now have created some promotion relegation, which is going to add some intrigue to how that works. I don't know. To answer your question, we have a commissioner who's done great. With the growth of the league has been awesome, and Don Garber. His initial background, he used to work for the NFL, and he was a commissioner of NFL Europe. So he was trying to grow American football in Europe, and now he's trying to grow the beautiful game in America, right? So it's kind of the same role in some ways. He just has that NFL mindset. And I love Lamar Hunt. He's done tremendous things for sports in general in this country, in the Hunt family. But he was very, we got to Americanize this game as much as possible. And I think we've actually gotten to a point where we could probably find some middle ground. And I think everybody would be cool if we didn't have playoffs. I think the games would still matter. Let's just the best team win after 38 games or whatever it is and call it a day. But we're working towards it. So I don't know. I'm really dodging your question. I don't know what the right answer is, because I think there's some layers to what the end game is. And I think that's, if I have any criticism of MLS, I feel like they react a little bit instead of anticipating or having somebody in place that works there going, where do we want to be in 10 years?
Yeah.
I think they do have that person now, because I can start to see some decisions that are shaping that, but they didn't have that person for a while. They were just kind of reacting, and fair enough. That's what happens in a growth. We're a very young league and that's not a criticism of that situation, but it would be nice to have somebody in place to help this thing continue to push in the right direction.
Okay. Describe your style of play as a player. And basically, if you can, for MLS fans, is there a player playing currently who's this generation's version of Jimmy Conrad?
That's a great question. I was a hard on my sleeve type of player. I think that my leadership qualities and personality were probably my strong suits. You were always going to get a good, honest effort from me. I might not play well every single game, and no player does, but that's a great one. I got to mentor Graham Zusi and Matt Beisler in particular, who played the same position as me. And so there are some elements of Bees. Bees was probably a little bit better of a passer of a ball, but I think there's some similarities there where you knew with Matt Beisler, you're going to get a good, honest effort every single day. And he was going to do everything he possibly could to try to win the game. So even if you had to dabble in the dark arts of defending, Dave, you know, you got to do what you got to do sometimes to make it happen. I wasn't afraid to do that at times. But, and I'm looking at you, Carlos Ruiz, but I would say that, I don't know, in terms of a player that I look at and think that's somebody who's like me, or I don't know, that's a tough one. I mean, I do see some players, Aaron Long, maybe a little bit to New York Red Bulls. He won Defender of the Year, I think 2 years ago, had a similar kind of where he was counted out, went down to a lower division, kind of proved himself and took that confidence, and now has turned it into, you know, a nice MLS career, and obviously parlayed that into the national team. So he kind of stands out in terms of just like grit and just being somebody's always going to lay it out. But I think from a local perspective, Matt Beisler would be a good choice, I think.
That's not a bad, you know, if somebody's going to compare, you know, maybe a lot of people who are watching this or listening to this don't remember you as a player necessarily, but if you say, well, Matt Beisler's a lot like me, that's a pretty good comparison, because he got quite a few caps with the American team or the U.S. national team.
He did. He played in one World Cup like I did, and, you know, went from, even though he was pretty highly touted and went to Notre Dame and had a good career, and I had to fight a little bit. I didn't get drafted and took a little bit of a different route to start our careers. Right. We both had to prove ourselves early on, and it took 3 or 4 or 5 years to really find that sweet spot. But once we did, we took off. So, you know, I have a soft spot for Beast. He used to train with me when I was the captain and he was a rookie, you know, and I'm really proud of everything he's accomplished. So it's an honor for me to compare myself to Beast, because I feel like we're kind of cut from the same cloth, as it were.
Did you see his announcement on Twitter?
Amazing.
When he signed with Austin.
Amazing. Know, yeah.
Killing his inner Matthew McConaughey.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it's great. I'm really proud of him for all levels, because I like to laugh, as you can probably tell. So I was really proud of Bees for coming up with something that creative.
And I want to ask you about another former Kansas City Wizard player. You replaced Peter Vermes as a defender. Obviously, Peter is the current manager of Sporting Kansas City, and he played when they were the Wizards. What kind of a player was Peter?
He was very similar to how he was, or how he is as a coach. So he's very intimidating, I'd say. You know, he definitely has a presence about him. And I think what has lent himself to being a great coach is the fact that he had a vision of how the game should be played. And I think he was probably coaching already when he was a player, putting guys in good spots to make plays. And what's interesting about his career is that he started as a striker and then moved, you know, back to the midfield and then back to the defensive line. So he really has a taste of how everybody should move within a team. And I think that really helped shape his philosophies and methodologies in terms of approach. And so, yeah, it's been, I'm not surprised that the success that Kansas City has had under his tutelage. And what I really like is off the field. You know, he's really pushed the ownership group to continue to try to be on the cutting edge and no, we should have this. And this is why. And, you know, so fair play to him for really having such an impact on the sport, specifically in Kansas City.
Well, there's mixed feelings here in Kansas City that he would make a perfect U.S. men's national team manager, but we don't want that to happen because we don't want to lose him. Do you think he'd be a good national team manager?
I do. I think my one concern would be that the national team is very hands-off for 9 months of the year, right? It's super intense for, you know, 2 or 3 months. And yeah, you're probably flying around and scouting players and making sure it's a lot of texting and making calls, you know? Yeah. And I just don't see that being PV's big thing. You know, I think he wants to be in the trenches. I think he wants to be thinking and talking about it every day. I think he wants to have an impact on players and how they play every day and to be around them. So yeah, he might say that, oh yeah, I'd want the national team job. And I'm sure there's some appeal to that, right? Because it's probably the coolest job you could have in the sport. But I just don't know if it would have that day-to-day challenge that I think he's drawn to. So that would be my big concern for him. I know that there was conversations for him to try to do both, which is so PV, right? Because he wants to be in control of everything. But I can understand why U.S. Soccer said thanks, but no thanks to that. So I'd be really surprised if he gave up the position. He's done so much and has worked so hard to kind of create the Sporting Kansas City magic. So for him to give that up for, you know, 9 months of just chilling. Yeah. I just don't see him doing that, but I'm sure he's thrilled to being considered for it.
It's interesting because I think that's different in a lot of sports. You know, you know, we just saw Urban Meyer, a very successful college football coach, be named the head coach of the worst franchise in the NFL right now, but he's moving up a level. And it seems so logical that, you know, you're a very successful coach in the highest level in American soccer. You'd want to move up to that, but it's just so totally different mindset that I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think maybe that's why I don't know if he's ever been approached, but he's not the current national team manager. Because he would need a way to channel his, how do I say this nicely? His aggression, his toughness.
It's intensity. Yeah.
There you go. That's a good way to do it. His intensity. Yeah. That doesn't have a negative connotation. He would need a way to channel that intensity. I mean, I'm intimidated when I'm doing a Zoom call with a bunch of other media members, and I ask, you know, okay, I got to raise my hand. I got to ask him a question. Is he going to bark at me? And he's a great guy. He's really nice guy. But he is so intense. I think that might be a reason why he's not the national team manager.
That's possible. You know, I think that the big draw right now, if you're a manager of his stature, who's accomplished as much as he has, the World Cup you want to be in charge of is the 2026 World Cup, the one that we're hosting.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you know, not only just the thrill and pride of being the national team coach, but to be able to do it in front of all of us and here and all that pressure next. I mean, that would tick a lot of boxes from an ego perspective and for a personal accomplishment perspective. And, you know, and just to prove to see if you can, you know, so there's going to be a lot there. If I was ever going to want the job, that's when I would want it. So we'll see through this World Cup cycle, he might change his mind. I mean, he, at some point we'll get to the spot in his career. He's like, I've done everything I'm going to be able to do here in Kansas City. I've accomplished everything I'm going to accomplish. The next step for me, to your point, with Urban Meyer is the next jump is to do the national team. So there are a lot of different roles within the national team. Obviously he could, you know, fill maybe that bucket in his life, fill that void by, you know, working with the youth national teams, making sure there's great communication through all the levels, which is what he's doing with Sporting, right? He's making sure the youth academy is robust and everybody's on the same page and working towards the same thing. So he just take it to the national team we could argue they could use some of that type of organization that he could provide. So
some of that intensity.
Yeah, that too. You know, and it's that intensity, some accountability. I will say though, I know Peter well enough to know that he just doesn't. I mean, every coach doesn't want to be asked a tough question, you know. And so I think he puts on an air of intensity so that you guys don't ask hard questions, because I think it's a protecting. It's like he's on the offense. He's already being defensive by being intimidating, right? He's already like, no, don't ask me the hard questions. I don't want to, you know, deal with it. I look forward to being a manager at some point, because I think the press conferences would be a lot of fun.
Oh, absolutely. I do enjoy them, especially when I don't have a question I have to ask, just to see him go back and forth with people. I want to talk about being on the national team, and you played in a World Cup and you were on the national team beyond that, obviously. What is it like to represent your country on, frankly, the biggest sports stage in the world?
I've never felt anything like it. To be able to represent your country in a World Cup feels, it's a lot of responsibility. You know that at that particular moment, everybody back at home has your back. Even the casual fans who might hate the sport are going to put on a jersey and support USA and chant USA through thick and thin. And so there's something very unique about that experience. And obviously, it was a big thrill for me on a personal level as someone that was a little more of a little engine that could to get to where I got.
And
there's a lot of emotion, I think, tied into that. But to be able to, you know, at that particular moment, be one of the best defenders for your country, to then take the field to represent all those people back home and to make them proud. I mean, you ultimately want to put on the jersey and put on a performance where they're like, I like that player. He represents me, you know? And so there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. But I think at that point, if you're playing for the national team, you are used to that type of pressure. You welcome that type of expectation, and it was awesome. I loved every single minute of it, and I wish I could go back and do it all over again.
I know I see you're wearing a Sporting Kansas City kit.
That's right.
Another good term. I want to ask you real quickly about soccer terms for those of us who grew up sure. calling it a field, calling them uniforms, calling them, you know, games, things like that. Talk about the language of soccer, the uniqueness of the language of soccer. I'm guessing it's mostly from the European influence and stuff, but just talk about all the different terms that are different and maybe where some of those came from.
Yeah. So a lot of it is generated from England. You know, they are convinced they created the sport and everything is revolved around them and what they think about the game. So I do have a bit of a problem with the Euro snobs. So for the people that call it a field, you know, they call cleats boots. Just keep calling it what you call it. I mean, that's the language that you speak and that's what you feel comfortable speaking. And it's if they have a problem with it, it's their problem ultimately. And I run into it sometimes now. I do a lot of media stuff. And if I call it soccer, oh my God, this is like we're talking about the same game. It just doesn't, just doesn't matter. I mean, if we go down to a Spanish speaking, it's football. Or if you go to Brazil or Portugal, it's futebol or calcio in Italy. And like, does it matter? I mean, are you giving Italians a hard time because they call it calcio? You know, it's just because there's this Euro snob. You have to speak pitch. You have to say, you know, boots. You have to say touchline instead of, you know, out of bounds. And all these others, like, it just doesn't matter. And so I just want people to embrace the sport, not feel intimidated because you're not saying the right terms. Just if you love the game, you love the game. And if those, it's their problem, not yours. So that's what I would say to that. And you can tell it's already struck a chord with me with regard to how much fight I have to do over something that's so nonsensical, but that's just kind of how it is. And I think there's an inferiority complex in some ways. I think they get defensive that we might be better than them at some point. And I always give my English friends a hard time that we're going to win our first World Cup before they win their second. And you want to get a reverse trigger. I get them going, you know? And so when you look at the players right now that we have that are domestic based, our Americans playing in Europe, I'd like to say that we have our younger players are playing at bigger clubs than those English players right now, some of them. So, you know, I think I could be spot on with that prediction at some point. And I hope that we win a World Cup in our lifetime, because then I would love to give the finger to all my English fans over there. Hey, what's up, guys? How are you?
And how cool would it be for that to happen in 2026 when the World Cup is played here on our soil?
Dave, I would be insufferable. I would be insufferable. I would just, that's the biggest fear, I think, around the globe is that the Americans on the men's side will win a World Cup. We're already dominating the women's side. People have accepted the fact that we're just going to own the women's game, and fair play to our women for being awesome. But on the men's side, obviously, we have a lot more work to do. And for us to do that, I think we're actually not in a bad spot. We have a lot of our younger players who are assuming more responsibility.
Yeah.
We have Christian Pulisic, just to give one example, wearing the number 10 shirt, which is a heavy responsibility for any club you play for Chelsea. And he's going to be 26, 27 in 2026, 28, maybe. I mean, they're all of our young guys that are doing well right now are all going to be in the peak of their careers in 2026. So I fully expect us to have a good run. And you know, you never know what's going to happen, because that'll be the, for everybody that doesn't know, there's 32 teams that play in the World Cup now. That 2026 is the first time they're going to expand to 48. And we don't need to get into the weeds on that. I just think that FIFA, the governing body, wanted to allow teams like Mozambique or Madagascar, you know, a chance to potentially participate. And I get it, right? You give a hope to these smaller countries to have a chance at the big dance, almost like March Madness, right? So you're, you're opening it up a little bit. So that will be a bit unique to see how we manage that. But I suspect that we'll have a good run. And big reason is because of the players that we're producing.
And that transitions into my penultimate question, the growth of American soccer. How excited are you about the fact that American soccer is Americans? I don't know if that's the proper British terminology, but anyway, American soccer is getting to the point where it's not just totally outlandish for you to make a prediction that USA will win its first World Cup before England will win its second. We're probably not there yet, but we're getting close. Just talk about how excited you are about the level of American soccer.
Yeah, I guess my number one word would be finally. You know, we've been talking about this sport being the sport of the future for I don't know how many years. And now there's finally building blocks in place to accelerate on those dreams and hopes. And you know, I guess the best example I can give is we have a player right now who is playing for Barcelona. And it's not a big deal. Like for the longest time, if you would have told me six years ago that we would have a player starting for Barcelona, you know, and then he'd be playing against another one of our American players who's playing for the top Italian club with Cristiano Ronaldo. We have another one playing with Messi, and it's, everybody's kind of accepted that it's fine. It's we got Americans, no big deal. Like, we finally kind of broke that stereotype that we can't play anymore. And I think that's the glass ceiling we needed to get through. Cause now I think those top European clubs will start to scout America in a more meaningful way, because we are producing a ton of great players, and MLS clubs can only handle so many of them, you know, and right. It's going to be interesting as this transition goes along, but yeah, things are definitely trending in the right direction. And I think the big challenge now will be to try to find the players that are falling through the cracks. I think our scouting could be a little bit better. I think our coaching could be a little bit better. I don't always get the sense that we're rowing the boat in the same direction here in this country with regard to everybody on the same page and doing what's best for the player. You have politics, you have, let's say, I think the best way to say it, the soft way to say it, is we have capitalism involved, you know, so there's a whole bunch of different things that sometimes impede us and we can't get out of our own way. But I think for the first time, we're starting to get out of our own way a little bit. And I brought up Don Garber earlier. He was very adamant about not selling any of our young American players, that we didn't want to lose them to Europe. But every league around the world, so everybody that doesn't know, everybody sells their best players.
Right.
Cristiano Ronaldo, Manchester United sold Cristiano Ronaldo. Okay. Manchester United sold David Beckham. Like, you, at some point, it's time to move those players on, and they're going to go on and do something different. It doesn't mean that league is better or worse.
Right.
It's just part of the process. And so 2 years ago, Don Garber came out and said, we're going to be part of the global market. We're going to start selling our younger players if it makes sense. We're going to start selling Miguel Almirón. There was a player at Atlanta who moved to the Premier League with Newcastle. All these moves are such an important part of it, not only for the players, but also for the optics. Now you see Europeans going, oh, cool, finally, we're not going to run into roadblocks if we work with MLS. They're finally open to working with us in a meaningful way. And that's going to really unlock a lot of different things. And I think that will end up continuing to, you know, all boats rise, right? Once something starts to happen here, then there's going to be more money. You sell one player, right? I think FC Dallas, I'll give you an example. FC Dallas is close to selling Brian Reynolds to Juventus in Italy for $8 million. That's going to fund their youth academy, David, for what? Four or 5 years? You know, it's just smart business, you know? Yeah. So finally we're starting to open up those gates. And once those are open, I don't think there's any point in stopping us. And we're going to, I mean, imagine the players are starting that are being sold now. And, you know, we have our younger players at 10, 11, 12, seeing players playing in Europe, getting to watch and play live in MLS, USL, the little lower division leagues, and having that exposure to it is going to be really important as more players want to play and see it as a great outlet to be creative and then hopefully be a professional themselves.
I want to wrap up with this. You talk about trending in a positive direction. I always like to give my guests a chance to talk about their family. I know you've got kids. Are they playing soccer? Just tell me a little bit about your family.
Yeah. So I've been married. Oh man. What year is it? I should know this right off the top, Dave. 19 years this year. We have two beautiful little girls, ages almost 14 and almost 10. They both kick the ball around, but I'm not forcing them to play. They both have the ability to push on, and they're very comfortable with the ball, which I think is really important to have a comfort level, because if you have a good first touch in this game, just like in any other sport, right? If you have that kind of base understanding of how to play, how to move, how to have success, then it just kind of unlocks some things if you do want to take that next step. So we're kind of on the precipice of that next step with our oldest in particular. And so she's just making decisions as to whether she wants to pursue that or music or, you know, all the other things that, sure, that she's exposed to, which is cool. But yeah, I've done a whole bunch of cool things in my life, but I think the coolest is being a dad. You know, you have the opportunity to kind of shape how, and I say it like this, and I tell them this too. I like to put tools in their tool belt, right? So I try to give them tools about awareness, especially as a woman in this society. You know, they're going to have different challenges than men, and trying to prepare them for life as it's currently set up, and how they can potentially help break down some of those glass ceilings and make the world a better place. So it's a big responsibility. It's one that I enjoy, and they're getting older, man. I can't squeeze them as much and hold them as little babies, but there is something special about being a dad. And so I really appreciate that. And my wife's awesome. She's got a great job, and, you know, I think she's a great role model for my girls. So we're cooking with gas over here, Dave, but it's been very cool. And thankfully my family's healthy throughout this COVID stuff, my extended family and my immediate family. And, you know, we're just trying to be smart and safe as we try to navigate the high seas of the new world order, but we're hopeful that it'll get back to normal, or quote unquote, the new normal at some point in the future.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time. Appreciate you joining us. I've enjoyed this. I feel like I'm talking to my son a little bit as you're talking all these soccer terms and just letting them roll off, but it's been very enjoyable, and I appreciate you joining us.
Yeah. Thanks, David. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.